Good morning. I'm Kevin Chambers, Director of the Toyota Peace Institute, and my colleague for this public conversation is Olivia Stokes Dreyer, Research Fellow with the Toyota Peace Institute. It's our privilege today to be in conversation with Lydia Khalil. Lydia is a Research Fellow on Transnational Challenges at the Lowy Institute, where she manages the Digital Threats and Democracy Project. She's on the editorial board of Studies in Conflict and Terrorism, and is a member of very different civil society and government programs addressing violent extremism. These different affiliations means that her academic work has a very practical and policy-oriented focus. She's the author of the book, Rise of the Extreme Right, The New Global Extremism and the Threat to Democracy, which provides the context for our conversation today. So, Lydia, welcome to this public conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you all today.
Great. Let's begin with a personal question. Could you tell us a little bit about your own academic and policy background and why you became interested in extremism in general and right-wing extremism in particular?
Sure. Well, my path to research in academia is actually quite an untraditional one. The majority of my work has actually been in the policy space, and I've been involved in, you know, national security and counterterrorism issues pretty much since the days of 9/11. I was a university student. I was just about to graduate. I was attending university in Boston, and that's when the 9/11 attacks happened. And at the time, I was majoring in international relations, focusing on Middle Eastern studies, and what I thought would be kind of a niche diplomatic area that I'd be working in, you know. And I was heading off to do graduate school and to do some interning in Washington. The 9/11 attacks happened, and then it kind of really changed the trajectory of a lot of my work. And so I ended up having a lot of US policy roles dealing with the aftermath of 9/11, the United States is, and indeed the globe's response to it. My particular interest in the Middle East in that area comes from my own personal background. My family background is Egyptian, and we migrated to the United States in the early 80s when I was quite young. We come from a minority religious community that was kind of discriminated and persecuted in Egypt at the time, and a lot of it had to do with the rise of Islamist extremism in Egypt. And so that was kind of my personal connection to that work. But obviously, issues around extremism and terrorism are not just relegated to jihadism and Islamism. This is something that spans the political and ideological spectrum. And I think that that's one of the things that we had forgotten about in the 9/11 decades, that this can manifest in many different ways. And we started to see over the decades that there are actually so many other threats related to that were obscured. And that's where it also led me to do work on right-wing extremism and other types of extremisms, which unfortunately we are seeing the manifestations of much more clearly and acutely, and how they impact democracies, particularly in the West, but also elsewhere that we live in.
Great, thanks for that.
All right, so Lydia, a warm welcome from me as well. I found your book tremendously helpful, if not sobering. We wonder, could you describe why you think the term right-wing extremism is better than other descriptors of what has become the most prevalent form of extremism today? Maybe why it's avoided in some countries, and what would you say its most salient features are?
Thanks, that's a really good question, and it's a question that I deal with a lot in my book, particularly in the beginning chapters, because the term right-wing extremism, I think off the bat, we have to acknowledge is a contested term. There's contestation around its definition, around its usage, around its utility. But I try to put some definitions and parameters around what it is in the book, and also make a case for why it should be used. Essentially, I like to use the scholar Elizabeth Carter's definition, which I think is very elegant and concise, which is an anti-democratic opposition to equality. Now, that manifestation, it can manifest in many different forms, a lot of it not necessarily in mass violence or terrorist type attacks that we are kind of used to associating with, like those mass casualty attacks. It can, we certainly saw that, say, with the Oklahoma City bombings in the 1990s in the United States and other forms of mass casualty attacks. But more often, it's a bit more insidious than that, which I think is where some of the squishiness around what we consider to be right-wing extremism and terrorism are. It can manifest itself in interpersonal violence, in protest violence, in hate-fueled violence. And so I think that that's where some of that confusion and fuzziness can come from in terms of what how it manifests. Another feature of right-wing extremism is belief in hierarchies. So putting people into categories and then ranking them, you know, according to what is more preferable or best, that's another feature of right-wing extremism as well. There's also often fascist tendencies that manifest in right-wing extremist beliefs as well. There's also a strong indication of nativist or anti-immigrant and migrant beliefs in right-wing extremism. Now, I've been asked actually a couple of times a really interesting question, which is if you're using that definition of an anti-democratic opposition to equality as your baseline of what right-wing extremism is, why then are you not counting, say, jihadism in that definition? Which was a surprising and interesting question that I've gotten, because it does have authoritarian tendencies. It is anti-democratic, and also there is issues around equalities within jihadism as well. So that really had me thinking and pondering my framework when I get asked questions like that. But I think the difference is that with jihadism and political Islamism, the difference is that there's an even further layer to that, in that they're trying to break down the nation state system as a whole. Rather, it's a transnational global movement that's trying to put forward another form of governance, a global type of caliphate. And so that's where I differentiate, say, between right-wing extremism and jihadism. Another question I get asked a lot is, well, what about left-wing extremism as well? And so certainly there are manifestations of left-wing extremism. We have seen it historically in the past be more prevalent than it is today. But I would say between the two, there's certainly a false equivalence. And that question is often one that's highly politicized between people who are trying to ignore or tamp down the threat of right-wing extremism as well. So I think, and that issue around politicization is another reason why I think that term is often not used. There's a political agenda in trying to avoid that term, particularly by far-right actors who are trying to kind of sanitize their programs, sanitize their ideas, and sanitize their ideologies, trying to remove themselves from that extremist label as well. Now, there's a lot of governments around the world, in the United States, in Australia, where I currently live and work, Canada, others who don't use the term right-wing extremism. They tend to use the word racially and ethnically motivated violence to describe that. And I think that might be, look, all well and good, but I think that there is an argument to be made for using that broader descriptor of right-wing extremism to understand these various manifestations of it as part of a spectrum, because it allows us to identify the through lines between different movements and different groups that might seem disparate, but are actually not. So we can make the connections between, say, you know, Hindutva extremists and white supremacists, which are there. And so if we put them under that umbrella term of right-wing extremism, it gives us that understanding and that framework to connect them, knowing they're not exactly the same things, but enough similarities that will allow us then to come together as a community, as policymakers, as practitioners, to understand the challenge that we're facing, and to come up with similar and more comprehensive solutions to addressing these challenges.
Thank you.
Great. In the book, you note a 320% increase in right-wing extremism, globally from 2016 to 2021. What do you think are the primary structural issues and the grievances and fears that are contributing to this?
So I identify a number of them in the book, and I want to preface it by saying that obviously these structural factors that I identify are not enough by themselves to lead someone to espouse you know, right-wing extremism or indeed any other kind of extremism, but they're part of the atmospherics that I think form an enabling environment for more people to become involved in these movements. So one of the ones that I identify is global inequality, and not just inequality, economic and political inequality within particular classes of people, but really what I'm talking about is elite capture. The difference between the 1% and the 99% has become so stark that it feeds into right-wing extremist ideas and conspiracies around this thing called the New World Order, which is a long-standing right-wing extremist conspiracy that says there's an elite group, global cabal, that's in control of all of the factors that are running our world. And it's our duty then to identify, to expose, and to fight that. And so this elite capture, this undeniable and statistically proven phenomenon that so much of our global resources are captured by a very tiny minority, feeds into that right-wing extremist conspiracy theory around the New World Order. That's very hard to deny, actually. The other one that I identify is this exponential rise in and spread in disinformation in conspiracy theories. Now, this is something, again, that's been around since the dawn of human history. There's always been kind of rumors and innuendo. You know, some researchers have even identified it as kind of an evolutionary mechanism, which I think is super interesting. But I think because of technology, the increased usage of internet allows information and false information and manipulated information to travel much more deeply and widespread. And that disinformation is then gamified. It's again, something that brings movements and social groups together around this disinformation and conspiracy theories. In my book, I talk with a former head of the neo-Nazi movement in the United States. And he was talking to me about his trajectory into that movement. And he was telling me about actually how difficult it was to find information when he was first interested about neo-Nazism in the United States. He said, I went to so many libraries. I tried to reach out to so many different people. And this was kind of before the, you know, the prevalent uses of the internet. And it wasn't until he, you know, he got to the back pages of a sociology book in a local library that he was actually able to connect with a movement that he wanted to connect with. Nowadays, you don't have to go through all of that effort and exertion. Because of the spread of and access of information via technology, digital and digital communication. The other thing that I identify is environmental degradation and the crisis of climate change. Now, this might be surprising to some people because they may be familiar with those on the far right who tend to engage in climate denialism and have blocked solutions for kind of comprehensive global solutions to the climate crisis. But there's actually really an important subset within right-wing extremist movements that have now espoused eco-fascism. And lastly, I'd say probably most importantly is global democratic decline. And this is a bit of a chicken and egg thing. It's rising extremism and polarization leads to democratic decline, erosion in democratic processes and governance and trust and faith in the democracy also feeds into polarization and extremism. But so many measurements across the board have consistently demonstrated democratic decline in both emerging democracies and consolidated and established democracies. And most, you know, most glaringly obvious is what's happening in the United States, but not just in the United States. You know, we're talking about the rise of far-right parties in Europe. We're seeing what's happening in India as well with the erosion of that multicultural democracy. So it's also happening outside of the Western context. So those are a few of the structural factors that I identify. But at the same time, I'll also reiterate and say that all of us are living under these conditions. Not all of us are running off to become violent extremists or even captured by, you know, right-wing extremist ideas. So there has to be something else going on at the social, psychological, personal level within an individual as well. And there's a number of those factors that are driving that, you know, need for community, need for, you know, clear answers, you know, lack of opportunity, concern about particular status, particular particularly among, you know, the majority or used, you know, majority populations that are used to kind of being the winners of society, concerned about their status in this kind of roiling, uncertain global environment that we're in.
To what extent would you say that left of center parties may unknowingly be responsible for, in some ways, facilitating right-wing extremism by shifting some of their historical focus from inequality and social justice to this increasing emphasis on what we could call identity conflicts and culture conflicts?
Well, I may not use the word responsibility exactly, but and I think a lot of, you know, this is something that I've kind of identified in the book, and I reference to a lot of the research and scholarship of political economist Thomas Piketty, who has outlined in various publications of his how the both left and right mainstream parties, particularly over the last decade or two, have become parties of the elite, of various elite interests. So on the left, that could be the intellectual or educational elite who are relatively comfortable in their status and station, who then have more of an inclination to discuss and examine issues around identity politics, for lack of a better word, that are not the main or the forefront concern of the middle to lower classes, who are much more concerned with, you know, issues around economic redistribution. And that provides an opportunity, I think, for far-right parties and extremist movements to come in and say, well, we are actually the ones who are identify with the working class struggle. We're the ones who can provide the answers that you're looking for. So there's some of that that's going on. I wouldn't say it's necessarily responsibility. Issues around identity, equality are extremely important, but they have to be tied into these other socioeconomic and economic redistributive policies that have been mostly absent, I think, in the neoliberal era. Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of left-wing parties would quibble with my characterization, and certainly not all of them are like that. And then you have seen a shift, I think, with this growing cognizance of global inequalities, where there is more of a movement to address those things. So I do see actually a shift moving in that direction, which I think is going to be positive.
Okay. Can you explain what you understand by parochial altruism, which I thought was a very interesting way of describing a lot of what you're talking about, and why does that subvert ideas of the common good?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of times people, when they, you know, look to extremists and see them espousing these either crazy or outlandish or harmful and violent ideas and positions, it's very easy to think of them as bad or evil. But for those individuals and for the groups that they work for, that's actually not their motivating factor. And that's not how they see themselves. And that's not what they're motivating, what's motivating them. In fact, what's motivating them is something more altruistic, is to do something for others. And this is a phenomenon that researchers have identified across all movements and extremist movements as well, that there's this particular type of altruism toward your own group, a desire to do something for your own group that leads you to do and to believe in and to espouse such extremist views. They see it as self-sacrificing for the group that they identify with. The problem comes when they are excluding others and only working for a self-identified in-group at the expense of and at the detriment to an out-group that they identify, an enemy that they identify. And so clearly that subverts the common good when you are slicing and splitting various categories of humanity and humans into, you know, friends, those we work for versus enemies, in groups versus out group. That in group, out group dynamic is really important to extremist movements. And so when you're only concerned with a very small subset of who it is that you identify with, and you don't identify with the global community or with humanity as a whole, and you don't see other people as equally human and vulnerable as yourself, then that's where we subvert the common good.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. Thanks. So you focus quite a bit in the book on hostility towards immigrants and refugees and how this is something shared by right-wing extremist groups really around the world, and what's getting called the Great Replacement Theory. Can you describe what the Great Replacement Theory is and why this is such a potent mobilizer for right-wing political movements?
Sure. So the Great Replacement Theory is actually a French idea. It arose out of the new right movement in France. And it's a conspiracy theory that says that the influx of migrants into Europe, France in particular, is again an elite conspiracy meant to weaken the traditional ethnic base, majority base of France, so that the elites can then better control society and have a group of immigrants and migrants who are subservient to them, who they can better control at the expense of the quote unquote native population. This idea did not just contain itself to France, but it spread throughout Europe. And it's actually quite similar to another conspiracy theory out of the United States around white replacement theory as well, which says that the white race in the United States and other white majority countries is being similarly impacted through this conspiracy theory of bringing migrants in order to control the population for elite interests in those nations and societies. This then spread to actually a political movement, an ideological movement called the Identitarian Movement out of Europe. And they tried to kind of position themselves as not racist and not, you know, ethnically hating or any of that stuff, but as a concerned group that were around migration and identity and the nature of European societies. But underneath that very polite facade was actually a really dangerous idea. And underneath that was a theory of re-migration, meaning that not only should we stop immigration, further immigration from coming, but that the migrants that are already there, that are not ethnic or the in-group of that society, need to be then forced out. Now, what is the natural consequence of re-migration but a violent expelling of those groups? And we have seen eventually identitarian movements being labeled as extremist movements, being exposed for what they are, but for a very, very long time, they were actually part of the mainstream political landscape. And that idea is now spreading to the, you know, to motivating violent extremist individuals, mass shooters, and movements on the right spectrum. The Christchurch killer was motivated by the Great Replacement Theory, or at least wrote about it quite extensively in his manifesto. A number of mass shootings that have occurred throughout 2019 up until now, most recently the Buffalo attacks in the United States, have been motivated by some version of this Great Replacement Theory. So it's actually become a very dangerous and violent idea that is spread globally. And we've also seen it in the Asian context, perhaps not labeled as such, but a similar dynamic and idea going on, where there is this outgroup that's labeled as migrant, that's labeled as dangerous to the native population in places like Sri Lanka, Myanmar, India, that have then that are then formed as an enemy or as an outgroup that that have been the target of attacks, of harassment, and of violence. And it's quite actually a very dangerous idea, not only because of the violence that it manifests, but because of its ability to kind of infiltrate mainstream political discourse as well, and questions and policies around immigration and migration and multi-ethnic societies in multicultural societies around the world.
Sort of moving on a little bit, and it kind of flows out of your concern around elite capture. It's a question about why right-wing extremists are insecure and anxious about status. And is this more marked in the 21st century than it was in the 20th, when arguably class differences played a bigger role? I mean, in this big kind of debate about status and class and so forth, but you know, a good deal of your book sort of focuses on status deprivation or relative deprivation theory and so forth. So can you sort of give us a little bit of an idea about why this is so important? This kind of feeling of lower status, elite capture is really taken off in the 21st century.
And, sure.
And as part of that also, I mean, there's a whole question around, you know, the old literature around working class authoritarianism, you know, where, you know, on the one hand you had Marxists who said that the working class was progressive, but then when push came to shove, they were arguably not.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting question. And I think the reason why I wanted to bring up this issue around status is because there's this, you know, there are these been ideas and theories rolling around for quite some time in terms of what motivates extremism and terrorism in the field. And we haven't quite come to an answer about that. But one of the theories that's been largely debunked is this idea of economic deprivation or, you know, class struggle by itself as motivating, or poverty as motivating terrorist and extremist violence. That's something that's been kind of going around, that's been largely debunked. So it's not so much that there are people who feel poverty or who feel unequal or who are of a lesser status or class, and that's what's driving them, but rather it's their own perception of their own status. So if you take a look at extremist movements around the world, or terrorist movements, you know, from jihadists even to right-wing extremists, who are the ones driving it? I mean, Osama bin Laden was not someone without status or resources, right? So many of the leaders of these movements are actually part of the elite, who are actually quite comfortable socioeconomically. If you take a look at the studies that have been done in terms of the participants of the January 6th riots in the United States, vast majority of them are actually from middle to upper middle class strata in society. It takes resources and time and energy to get yourself from California to Washington, D.C. to participate in these type of movements. So I wanted to talk about this issue around the perception of status rather than actual status, one, in order to kind of continue to debunk this idea that it's, you know, poverty or, you know, lower anxiety around, you know, or particularly around economic positions, but rather it's your own perception of it. And oftentimes that lack of perceived status or status anxiety comes from those who actually hold it, but and who have been the traditional winners of society. So in white majority cultures, it would be, you know, say white male majority, you know, or white majority middle to upper middle classes, who have some sort of anxiety around others reaching or potentially surpassing them. Again, it's this in-group, out-group dynamic that's layered on top of issue around status, meaning that it's kind of like a zero-sum game to them. If you win, I lose. And if you're perceived as having more ability to access resources in society or status in society or opportunities are then expanded, it's a diminishment of me and my status.
In relation to that, I've wondered, particularly in the US, just from my own observations, of to what extent sort of the women's movement, then the Me Too movement, to what extent men, white men especially, feeling that their status is being eroded, that they're being shamed on some level, whether that's contributing as well.
Yeah, I have a number of colleagues who are actually doing some really great work around the idea of male supremacist ideas and ideologies that are part of the right-wing extremist spectrum. So we have kind of male supremacist movements, that the incel movement, the manosphere, the online manosphere, as they call it, all these kind of part of these movements that are this reactionary response to, I think, to feminism, to the Me Too movement, to concerns around the reorientation of the role and expectation of men in society. So I think you're certainly right to pick up on that dynamic, that part of this is a reactionary element to gains of that women have made in society. And if you take a look at the statistics around men and their role in particular societies in the United States, you know, women are achieving greater levels of educational attainment. You know, there are more households that are being driven by, you know, the woman's income. There's fractures, I think, within family structures that people are still coming to grapple with. And so this is something I think that can give rise to some of these more fringe and extremist elements as a response to some of these dynamics that you just, that you bring up.
Yeah, good. So in what ways has the pandemic been an accelerant of what was already happening in terms of the rise of right-wing extremism, and how in particular have you seen this manifest, say, in the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand?
Sure, well, I can probably particularly speak best to the Australian context, because I'm currently living in Melbourne, which was one of the most locked down cities of the world during the pandemic. You know, we were under heavy lockdown for the better part of a year, you know, give or take various breaks in between. And we certainly saw a rise in anti-government sentiment because of that, which then right-wing extremist figures and movements attempted to exploit. We also saw this intersection between the anti-vax and anti-establishment medicine movement with other far-right movements as well. That kind of came together and consolidated a bit more during the pandemic. But I think also another thing that's driving it is that for the very first time, many people around the world, I think living in Western democracies, have felt truly for the first time the heavy hand of the state and what government can do to restrict them and to restrict their movements, and they didn't like it. Now, if you talk to kind of minority populations, ones that are heavily policed, they have no, you know, they have no illusions about what the state can do.
They're used to it, yeah.
Yes. And even though these measures are done in the name of public health and for a positive thing, it put a strain, I think, on a lot of people, and it was a wake-up call, actually, to just how intrusive this state can be under a state of emergency, you know, in something like the pandemic. And they certainly did not like it, and they didn't feel, again, because of these issues around status, it wasn't something that they were used to. It wasn't comfortable to sacrifice or to suffer in the name of the public good, in a sense. Now, many people, particularly in the Australian context, were very supportive of the public health measures, I think more so than in other Western democracies. But at the same time, there's no denying that there's a subset of society where that grew, and right-wing extremist movements and far-right influencers tried to capitalize on that and did capitalize on that. Also, it isolated us, the pandemic, from one another. And so if you are missing social connection, that social fabric that makes us all human, that was highly distressing for so many of us. And for some of us, that manifested in spending a lot of time online, being exposed to particular ideas, again, with that thing that we were talking about with the ease of disinformation flowing through, becoming captured by some of these ideas and these movements. And I think what's going to be interesting to see going forward is how much of that is actually going to stick versus what's going to go away with the easing of the pandemic and of restrictions. Will so many of these people kind of get back to life as usual, or will there be a residual kind of effect in terms of their involvement in far-right movements, anti-government movements, and what that will look like in the future? And I think that that's an unanswered question, but it'll be interesting to see, at least from a researcher perspective, how that's going to manifest moving forward.
It seems that during the pandemic, I mean, maybe this was happening before, but it also brought together these unlikely bedfellows, in a way, of these you know, these right-wing extremist groups, the more libertarian groups, the anti-vaxxers, that, you know, sort of certain in the US anyway, certain elements that, that you would have thought of as the left coming together with the right. And yes. I'm wondering if you saw this in other places, if you see that, yes. if you see that that's going to stick there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that really stood out to me very, very much in the beginning of this pandemic. It's one of the things that I actually honed in on in terms of my observations and research and tracking in terms of what was happening with the far right space and the pandemic, which was, as you say, strange bedfellows that actually, when you dig a little bit deeper into the history and the background of some of these movements, are not so strange. So here I'm talking about people becoming involved, who are involved in alternative wellness, for example, you know, yogis, you know, old hippies, people like that, he would think that they're kind of part of the left, really embracing a lot of this anti-government, you know, pandemic and COVID conspiracies, you know, former yoga practitioner or yoga practitioners talking like they're Donald Trump. And it was, I think, jarring to some people. But when you take a look at the history of far-right movements, extremist movements, fascist movements, there's actually quite a lot of crossover in terms of issues around bodily autonomy, mysticism, alternative health. I mean, take a look at the history of the Nazi movement, for example, in Germany, and you will find a lot of those threads. Now, I'm not trying to equate Nazism with, you know, with what necessarily we're seeing, but they're not entirely devoid of each other. So what seems like strange bedfellows are actually not. So this idea of anti-establishment medicine, of the atomization of the body, of bodily purity as being extremely important, it's really only a hop, skip, and a jump away from some more extreme fascist, even neo-Nazi ideas as well. So there's a lot of connections in through lines.
Good, thanks for that. Moving a little bit on to your arguments about right-wing extremism not being confined to the West, you nicely used Myanmar, Sri Lanka, and India as case studies to demonstrate that extremism isn't exclusively a Western phenomenon. What do you see as the similarities and differences between Asian and Western right-wing extremism?
Well, I think it goes back to some of the elements of the definition that we were discussing earlier. So this in-group, out-group dynamic, you know, tensions around various ethnicities and religions. But one of the key ones really is Islamophobia. Islamophobia is an anti-Muslim sentiment and hatred among the far right in the West is one of the big connecting threads between what's those movements in the West and in the East. So we're seeing, there always been, say, communal tensions in India, for example, but with the rise of the Hindutva movement, its champion under Modi, who gives legitimacy to that project. You know, we're starting to see more anti-Muslim sentiment arise, this fracturing of the multicultural and multi-ethnic nature of India. In Sri Lanka, Islamophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment is very prevalent in those movements that are more anti-equality, authoritarian. Same thing in Myanmar. I think it might be one of the more controversial ideas and contested ideas that I put forward in the book, admittedly, because I think there's also arguments to be made, well, that these are separate type of phenomenon. For example, in Myanmar, you know, this is a country in transition. This is a lot about your traditional type of ethnic conflict. But I tried to push the boundaries a little bit in the book to kind of make us think a little bit about, well, okay, that might be the case, but look, there's also an argument to be had that there's these similarities around Islamophobia, fascist tendencies, the demonizing of an other ethnicity and race for the in-group, the majority in-group, the true, the native population of a state that I think manifest both in East and West nicely. But like I said, it's one of the parts I think of my argument that can be most contested. I'm always interested in having those conversations, but I wanted to kind of push it a little bit to see if we can maybe think about this idea more expansively, or these movements more expansively, in order to help us better tackle them.
Yeah, I think you argued that well in those chapters, Olivia.
Sure. So right-wing extremists in general seem to have this sense that the white race, white civilization is in decline. Is there actually any evidence for this? And how does this narrative morph into not only opposition to multiculturalism, but to LGBTQI rights, feminism, this amorphous global elite, Jews, mm-hmm. Muslims, as we've said, liberal democratic governments, period. So, you know, what is that trajectory as you see it?
Yeah, there is certainly statistical evidence or demographic evidence in within certain country contexts. So I write about how in the book, the United States will become a minority majority country quite soon. And so that demographic reality is feeding into this anxiety around white population and white populations in decline or being eradicated. But I think what those demographic concerns or statistics miss out on or override is actually that there's quite more complexity on the individual and family level. So there's a lot more of inter-ethnic, interracial marriages and families coming together. So identity and definitions around race are actually expanding and being challenged across the board. I mean, I'll give you an example just from my background. So I'm Egyptian background. When we moved to the United States, you have the census data, and the census data around race is incredibly confining. You know, it's white, Black, Hispanic, Native American, and not very much room for all else. And Egypt in particular is a country that defies racial categories. It literally defies Black and white. It is an African nation. However, it's North African, it's not sub-Saharan. So I couldn't quite put myself in the African-American category. I can't quite exactly count myself white, even though technically on the census, that's what it should be. And so I think these diversity of ethnicities that are coming in, the prevalence of intermarriage, our expansion of what identity, both gender, race, sexual identity is expanding. And so that complicates the picture, I think, for individuals and movements who are looking for kind of clear-cut Black and white older answers to, mm-hmm. to what society is like. And you're also right to point out that this anxiety around a white population in decline also feeds into homophobia and anti-LGBTQI and anti-trans narratives and ideas, because they see that as the denigration of the traditional family, the traditional white family that can then come together, marry, husband, wife, have children, and replenish the population, so to speak, in their own minds. And so they see those changes that are occurring in terms of people's fluidity or openness to embrace other sexual identities and gender identities as something that's a direct challenge to that, and feeds directly into this anxiety and concern around a white population that's in decline.
Yeah. That makes sense.
In your book as well, you raise some very interesting questions around the connection between right-wing extremism, violent gaming, and then the internet narratives of sort of celebrating mass murder of different target groups. I mean, how do these sorts of things connect to what you call accelerationism and destruction for the cause?
Yeah, so I think this kind of gamification around extremism and violence is a bit separate to ideas around accelerationism, but certainly what the online environment has done, in particular online subcultures, has really desensitized people to violence. If not desensitized, then allowed a growing acceptance of the use of violence through things like subversive humor, through shitposting, through memification, through all of these things that make real world violence and othering and hatred a lot more acceptable. Now, gaming culture is incredibly prevalent across the world, right? I mean, it's truthfully not something that I'm engaged in or know a lot about, but a lot of colleagues who work in the terrorism and extremism space are, and they'll be the first ones to tell you that just because you're playing some even violent video games doesn't necessarily mean that that's a path toward radicalization, right? But there are particular subcultures and there are elements to gaming, online subcultures in gaming that can do that and have done that. And there's really big questions, I think, in the terrorism and extremism field around this phenomenon of online radicalization. Is it a thing? We still really don't know. You know, we haven't quite grappled with that, I think, as a field or have any clear-cut answers to it. There's certainly affordances and logics to particular platforms and online subcultures that can do that. Is it enough on its own? There are very, very few examples of pure online radicalization, so to speak. But it's certainly a dynamic that you can't deny is part of a growing prevalence of that. The Christchurch attacker, for example, was heavily involved in online subcultures that the Royal Commission has identified as contributing a lot to his violent trajectory. So there is certainly that dynamic there. In terms of accelerationism, it's this idea that a lot of right-wing extremist movements have espoused that they will look to anything to bring the downfall of society, which is why you have movements like the Boogaloo movement, for example, supporting the Black Lives Matter protests, which they see as destabilizing to society, polarizing to society, which will then ultimately bring it down so they can bring up a new programmed society, ideology, political program that they want up through its ashes. A lot of the mass shootings, for example, that have been mass shooters who have been cultivated in an online subculture commit these mass shootings in the hopes of accelerating society's demise or society's polarization to do exactly that same thing. So there is a connection, even though they are different phenomenons, but it is that accelerationist tendency, I think, is concerning because it shows that any crisis, again, and this is where the pandemic fits in as well, it was a crisis opportunity to accelerate the demise of society so they can build their own political and societal program on top of that. So it's all of those things that feed into each other.
You mentioned in the book as well that Russia, there was a lot of right-wing identification with Russia. And in terms of Russian interference in the US election campaign and Russian interference in a lot of different groups and movements in Europe, I mean, are they playing a critical role in this accelerationism kind of generation of chaos?
They're certainly playing a role for sure, and I think multiple roles. And it touches their role touches upon a lot of the dynamics that we've already discussed. So, for example, in terms of fomenting societal polarization and fraying, in terms of the interference in the US elections, for example, a lot of attention was being paid to what they were doing, say, in right-wing online spaces or with right-wing narratives. But they were equally doing it in the left as well. You know, they were very egalitarian about where they were spreading their active measures and disinformation campaigns in order to foment that polarization in the US to foment that chaos and instability. We spoke about how issues around the traditional family and traditional society, traditional Christianity, even in terms of the program of white nationalists. And for many far-right figures, right-wing extremist figures, and even neo-Nazi figures, which is surprising given Russia's history in terms of fighting the Nazis in World War II, Vladimir Putin is the one who is seen as the savior, the champion of these traditional values. And so they look to Vladimir Putin and Russia as the model for this anti-LGBTQI, homophobic, champion of traditional families, championing of traditional gender roles. So Russia plays a role in that as well. And so does the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
I've recently finished writing a chapter for an edited volume, actually taking a look at how Orthodoxy, Christian Orthodoxy, has become appealing and enmeshed as well with the far right. And that's of particular interest to me as someone from the Orthodox community to see how so many different types of communities and religions can then become captured or enmeshed in also these type of far-right ideas as well. So when I mention that, and when I also talk about what's happening in Asia, I'm trying to do that to really promote this idea that it's not just limited to kind of a subset of Europeans or white societies or groups, that this is actually something concerning to all of us.
Yeah. So in what ways do you see it kind of along these lines becoming a transnational, internationally networked phenomenon? And what are some of the new threats that poses?
Yeah, so these a lot of these right-wing groups and ultra-nationalist and white nationalist groups, or even in the Asian context or what have you, have traditionally been studied and perceived as local national movements, that they are concerned about their own nationhood, their own in-group, and have not really or comprehensively been looked at as transnational movements. Now, historians of the far right and right-wing extremists can tell you a different story, because they've delved into this and can demonstrate through the historical record that there indeed have been a lot of international connections between these movements. A clear one is between the RSS and the Nazi Party in Germany. That's just but one example. But again, we're starting to see this, not only connections between the various movements, but their perception of themselves as a transnational movement is growing. A transnational movement, say within the white nationalist faction of right-wing extremism, that sees themselves as a transnational movement that is protecting the global white race rather than Southern Americans or French or Germans or what have you. That conceptualization of themselves as a transnational movement is something I think is relatively new, one that's been aided by the digital environment, the ease of communications, internet technology, globalization. We also, my work on jihadism has actually helped provide a good comparison to that as well, because when you studied political Islamist movements or jihadist movements in the past, in the beginning, they were very much focused on their national parameters. So you had Egyptian movements, Saudi movements, Jordanian. And then over time, through greater globalization in the early 90s, they did tend to come together. Now, the two examples are not completely analogous by any means, but I think they do offer us an interesting comparison and jumping off point to kind of understand the growing transnationalization, I think, of white nationalist movements. And indeed, far-right movements globally. So you have far-right movements in the UK, for example, looking to what's going on in India as examples for what's to follow. Indian memes and disinformation and conspiracy spread online have moved over to what Europe and the UK have been spreading as well. So this is something that we're seeing and that's increasing. And again, Russia has played a role in this and trying to bring together a lot of these movements. They've hosted, for example, international far-right conferences in Russia. Scandinavian far-right and extremist movements have also played a big role in this as well. And so this is something that we're seeing more of with the ease of communication and with growing globalization.
Do you think this is leading to a kind of intensification of the movement, and is it giving rise to new threats, or
I think this is a watch and see space for me, I think, because some of these efforts at transnationalization have not been entirely successful. Some of them have faltered. Some of them, they have kind of ebbed and flowed. We've seen peaks of international kind of cooperation and coming together and networking, and then having it wane a bit. So we haven't seen like the rise of, say, a right-wing extremist Al-Qaeda, for example, like a truly global right-wing extremist movement in that sense. So we're certainly not seeing that. But there's also, I think, a more latent dynamic that's going on in terms of the globalization of particular forms of far-right culture. So in the book, I talk about, say, global MMA festivals that are very popular with the global far-right that connects and networks them. Music.
And can you say what MMA is?
Oh, mixed martial arts. Yes, sorry, festivals. You know, music festivals that do similarly, and certainly the digital environment enables that. A very well-known extremist scholar, Cynthia Miller Idris, has written a lot about the culture that binds a lot of these far-right movements globally. So on these kind of cultural narrative type of things, you certainly are seeing a greater globalization of what it means to be a part of the far right.
Yeah. And I imagine an increasing sense of community and meaning in terms of participating in something that's taking on global proportions as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Following on from that, you describe very well in the book how right-wing extremism entering mainstream political discourse and becoming acceptable. Can you sort of give us some indication of how this is actually undermining political legitimacy, weakening state systems, and contributing to the decline of democracy and the rise of authoritarianism everywhere?
Yeah, it's a huge question, right? It's a huge issue. I think we can probably talk about that for another couple of hours because there's so many things that are feeding into that. But one of the things that I try to highlight is that with right-wing extremism, it's a very different order level of threat than I think, say, jihadism ever was, in particularly in Western societies, because with jihadism, it was always going to be a niche fringe movement appealing to a very, very small subset of the population. With right-wing extremism, it's a different story because it's coming from the majority. And we've seen the rise of far-right politicians in Europe with Trump, with Modi, giving legitimacies to some of the more extremist elements of the far-right. So on one hand, you know, if we take a look at the example that's of the United States, right-wing extremists and neo-Nazis and white nationalists in the US were buoyed by the election of Donald Trump. They saw his election as a legitimacy to their movements. To them, they thought, yeah, actually there is a quiet majority that might believe or does believe in some of the ideas or some parts of the ideas that we're trying to espouse, and given a little bit more time and a little bit more effort or infiltration in politics, then we actually can see ourselves becoming a success rather than a fringe movement. At the same time, a political far-right figure does not go far enough. And so that prompts them then to push the envelope in terms of their extremism and violence onto society. And I think the Charlottesville rally was a really clear manifestation of that intersection between far-right politics and right-wing extremism, and how they can feed into and legitimize and then cause danger and violence and death to societies. And I think that's really where that danger lies, is that it can come from the majority. I talk to a lot of policymakers now, and there really is a struggle in terms of where to direct countering violent extremist programs to, because it's kind of arising from various pockets, and they're seeing some version of those ideas sometimes repeated or espoused, particularly around stuff like law and order, particularly around immigration, by far-right political parties and figures. Mm-hmm. And I think what far-right political parties and figures do is that they use democratic procedures to gain power, but they then do not become democratic or erode democracy. Clearest example of that is Orban and Hungary. I don't know if we can count Hungary anymore as a democracy Orban and what he's done with that society, but he gained power through elections. He continues to hold elections, but elections again are never enough. And this is also where I go back to my earlier experiences, looking at jihadism, and as someone from a country where they were the majority and the mainstream, or they were coming from the majority and the mainstream. So jihadism, say in Egypt or in Jordan or other Muslim majority countries, was a different level of threat than it was in the West, mm-hmm. even with the 9/11 attacks, because it was coming from the majority of the population. It was infiltrating politics. It was, you know, being captured, you know, or espoused by the mainstream of society there, so much in many of the ways that we're seeing right-wing extremism and far-right occurring in the West. And so that has been a really instructive history and example to me of understanding the dynamics that are going on.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, so you speak in the book about how the extreme right often decries what's perceived to be government overreach, particularly that happened during the pandemic. And yet at the same time, there seems to be this attraction to authoritarianism and to seeing Putin as representing this sort of leader who can bring back what people are longing for. So how do you square this seeming contradiction of the one hand, not wanting government interference, on the other hand, looking towards authoritarianism?
I think the appeal of authoritarian tendencies is that those who, you know, of semi-fascist, fascist, authoritarian type of figure, say like Trump, appeals because he's saying, I will look out for your interests. And if they feel like the authoritarian leader or the authoritarian system is working for them, then it's highly appealing. Because I think there are some legitimate and very objective evidence that democracies, particularly over the past couple of decades, have not provided the solutions to people's mm-hmm. problems and concerns because of a variety of factors, because they're not working as they should, because of polarization, because of congressional gridlock, because of so many other things, because of lack of trust in elected leaders, because of corruption, because of corporate capture and corporate interests governing democratic politics. People are seeing that. So on the one hand, there's a real objective and true factor to all of this stuff that erodes people's belief in democracy. And that's why I argue that in order to combat this problem, it's going to require no less than the reinvigoration of democracy. So there's that aspect of it, a real legitimate concern around what democracy can do for society. But then the appeal of an authoritarian leader or authoritarian promise, because they're saying, we're going to do away with the messiness of democracy and procedures, and I'm going to look out for your interests in particular. And more than that, I'm going to look out for your interests at the expense of someone else's. And for someone with that mindset, that's highly appealing.
Yeah. Lydia, we're nearly at the end of the interview here, but we can't leave on a kind of a pessimistic note. So, what do you think governments, civil society actors can do to curb the spread of right-wing extremism? And how do we make our democratic institutions and communities more immune, more resilient, and capable of recognizing it when we see it and countering it?
Well, one of the things that's really encouraging to me that I think for a long time we've really seen a complacency around the value of democracy and democratic governance. And I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think the January 6th riots were a real wake-up call to a lot of people. I think the evidence of global democratic decline around the world is another wake-up call. We're not taking things for granted as much as we are anymore. At the same time, we are still seeing the election of far-right figures, you know, recent European elections as evidence of that. But I think there is this movement among other parties that are not far right to address some of those structural concerns that we're talking about. I think there's a growing movement, I think, to address the effects of climate change. You've seen the election of various governments around the world who now are more committed to climate action, say in the United States and in Australia, two examples that I can think of where that's happening. So there's less of the complacency. There's more of an awareness. I think that's all positive. I think that we're living in some really not, you know, unprecedented times, because every time has its challenges. And, you know, we've lived through, or humanity's lived through famines and plagues and world wars, and has continually rejuvenated itself for better or worse. And so hopefully this can kind of be another time for that. But we do have a set of unique challenges on our hands in terms of addressing climate change, addressing the effects of technology on our society, understanding that, you know, these issues that we're talking about with right-wing extremism and other forms of extremism are all manifestations or reactions to all of these more deeper seated problems. So if we have a recognition that there's, we got to deal with kind of what's underneath the tip of the iceberg, mm-hmm. then that can be a really positive way forward, rather than just kind of dealing with the most extreme elements or the most violent elements of the problem that we're dealing with. I say too in the book that, you know, part of the reason why I'm interested in studying terrorism and extremism in particular is because, not just because it's kind of a weird, fascinating, you know, very acute type of naughty problem or challenge, but because of what it tells us about what's really going on. So sometimes in order to perceive what's really happening in the center, you have to look at it from the outside. You have to look at it from the extreme fringe elements, the edges. And so I think that that's where the study of extremism can really assist us. And so if we have that greater awareness of what's happening in the middle, that the fringe is manifesting, then I think that that can be the start of where we focus our efforts and where we focus potential solutions.
Thanks for writing a wonderful, wonderful book. I think you captured many of the anxieties and that those of us of the left-wing persuasion kind of feel about the way in which the world is going. You've given us some very good diagnostics, and I think it behoves all of us now to begin thinking about where we are and what we're doing to kind of create environments and atmospheres within which, you know, we can really begin addressing global inequality, the perception of elite capture, the challenges from global climate change, and so forth. But you've done more than that. I think you've written a great book. You've demonstrated that you're an extraordinarily articulate and wonderful human being, and I'm very pleased that you come out of that Coptic tradition, which has generated so many wonderful multilateralists, like the former Secretary Generals of the United Nations and others. So thank you for everything, and thank you for sharing your time with us, and I hope the book sells well and is heard by many and read by many and attended to by many.